No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by the world's most amazing co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and that affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to call in on 888-627-6008, or you can Skype questions to BBSRADIOPR. We have a special guest tonight, but first let me introduce my amazing co-host, Maria Sanchez, who I'm sure has gotten another degree since the last time we were on the air. How are you doing, Maria?
Oh, I'm struggling. This dissertation process is humbling. But it's going. It's going. It's going. I've never experienced anything like it. So thank you for asking. And you and your family and Mrs. Brown?
Oh, they're still, you know, giving me a hard time and you know, pushing me around. But that's the way they, you know, I come from an Italian family. So that's how you show your love. You know, if somebody's not bothering you about something. But so everything's going okay here. Great.
Good.
We had an amazing thing happen. I got to share this real quickly before we get Ann on the phone. I was coming in to watch the debates the other night, and my dog took off, and he was gone for 12 hours in the middle of one of the most highest areas of traffic in the city, and we were so worried about him, and we had him on all the listservs, and my son and I were out for 3 hours in the car looking for him in different directions. We never found him. The next morning, some woman who saw him at the bus stop across the street, where I'd been out in the front yard 50 times, but he had never seen him, was taking him, realized he wasn't on didn't have a collar on, was going to take him home so he would be safe. And then she looked at him and said, you know what? I saw this dog across the street in a window one time. And she walked over to the house and brought him home. And he was fine.
And now, what was he doing for 12 hours, that little
rascal?
I don't know.
But we're never letting him out again. I can tell you that.
Yeah, my puppy, she just sits on the driveway or the front steps watching the comings and goings, and everyone's like, doesn't she run away? And I was like, no, she knows a good thing.
this guy took off. He took off like we had set him on fire. But anyway, we've got bigger issues to talk about then. But thank you, by the way. I just want to say thank you if anybody's out there listening that look for the dog, because everybody in the neighborhood, I got so many emails about the dog. I said to Pat, you know, if we lost our son, there wouldn't have been that many emails. People just love dogs.
Yes.
And so thank you, anybody out there that's listening that searched for the dog.
Nice.
And now, more importantly, we have a very special guest tonight. And Ann Anderson is with the League of Women Voters. She's with the local League of Women Voters. They're very big advocates for D.C. statehood. And we're happy to have her on the show, and we've got so many issues that we want to talk about, because women are at the center of politics again as we go into an election year. And as you may or may not know, our listeners may or may not know, it's been 100 years since women got the right to vote in America, and the League of Women Voters is celebrating its 100th anniversary as well. So, Ann, are you with us? Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Glad to be with you. Yes, it has been 100 years. It was February 14th that the National League of Women Voters organization was born, and that's what we've been celebrating for the last 10 days. And in D.C. I mean, we decided to have a 10-day celebration, centennial 10 days of action. And the National League actually established a day of action on the 14th. And do you know there were like over 300 events of one kind or another all over the country?
Nice.
Yeah, it was really cool. So.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. And I assume that February 14th was picked specifically to for the day the organization was formed for obvious reasons, right? You know,
about, well,
they picked Valentine's Day to
Saint Valentine's Day, right?
Yeah,
Cupid, pull that Cupid.
Well, just,
bow and arrow,
you know,
back.
Kind of,
and
you know, I would think from a PR guy, I would have picked it because, you know, it's kind of have a heart, you know, have a heart day, and include women in our political process. So,
well, that would be a lovely way to do it. I'm not really sure exactly why it ended up being on the 14th. It might have been just when the papers got signed, you know? I don't know.
Well, so. It just shows that God's on your side, maybe.
Maybe
that's why the papers got signed. And, you know, several years ago, Ann, there was a group called the Young Suffragists in Washington, you may remember this, that went up to Capitol Hill with little kids and gave Valentine's to all the senators and said, you know, won't you be my senator on Valentine's Day. So it's a great day to celebrate.
Well, it really is.
So, Maria, go ahead. I don't want to monopolize Ann's time. I'm sure you have a question.
So what I find interesting about the League of Women Voters is that you're grassroots, nonpartisan activists, and sometimes the League of Women Voters is aligned with the Democrats. And is it just because they're more progressive in terms of their policies? Because they were founded by the National American Women's Suffrage Association in Chicago. So it sounds like it was just about getting women and the 19th Amendment passed. Can you speak to that, Ann, about the history and the legacy?
Yeah, absolutely. Let me go on my nonpartisan rant here. So,
okay, good. Thank you.
Sure. First of all, yes, we are a grassroots organization. All of our policies and positions come from the grassroots and go on and get eventually up to the national organization. And everything is researched. So we are nonpartisan. We do not align ourselves with any party or any candidate. We do not work for candidates. And if there is a position that the League of Women Voters has taken on an issue, then if it happens to be one party or another that also says that's the way to go, well, then there it is. But that is not the League's position. We are a nonpartisan. And so, for instance, you know, guess what? I'm going to talk about D.C. statehood. Mm-hmm. It's so partisan right now. But the League of Women Voters considers D.C. statehood to be a civil rights issue, mm-hmm. a human rights issue.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, while some people may turn it into a partisan fight, that's not how we see it. And so, you know, that's why we are for D.C. statehood, because we protect voters, we educate voters. And in fact, in this last year, when the national staff went around to the various state conventions, they carried them with them a PowerPoint that used D.C. and our lack of representation in the national legislature as a prime example of voter suppression. And that's what we're fighting on, is against any kind of voter suppression. So.
And you know, we should point out that in the District of Columbia, although this has turned into a partisan battle on Capitol Hill, the Republican Party in the District of Columbia supports D.C. statehood the same way the Democratic Party in D.C. supports it. So locally, I mean, nationally, it is a very partisan issue, but locally, it's really not a partisan issue because, as Ann points out, it really is a civil rights issue. It really doesn't get any more basic than You pay taxes, you serve in the military, you do everything that's expected of you under the social contract, you deserve to be represented. It's about the basic civil rights issue as you can get, I think.
Exactly. And one of the things that I say was, well, you know, people say, well, the Republicans will never vote for it because you'll get two Democratic senators. And I say, really? Is that for sure true? Do you really know? How do you know that? And then I say, look, there were 11,000 people who voted for our current president in D.C. They're not enfranchised either. The second highest group in D.C. that's registered are independent voters. They don't have a voice in Congress. And remember when Hawaii and Alaska came in, they were brought in as a pair because, oh, Alaska was never going to vote, you know, whatever. And then Hawaii was never going to vote whatever. And they've switched over.
Right. And that's exactly right. They said there would never be a Republican in Alaska or voted a Democrat in Hawaii, which is just, I don't know that there are any Democrats in Alaska, you know, in public office, and I'm pretty sure there are no Republican elected officials from Hawaii. So, yeah, those things change. They really do.
Well, and then let me just add one more piece to this. You know, right now, I think it's pretty clear that most of the people who are in public office in D.C. come from the Democratic Party. And so guess what? If you want to be involved in local politics, what really happens in D.C. happens in the primaries. We have a closed primary system. So it doesn't matter what you think about it. If you want to be involved, you have to be a member of the Democratic Party in order to vote in the primary, because then whoever gets out of the primary is pretty much going to win the general election. So we have no idea what the philosophical positions are of the people who live in the District of Columbia, because we are in a colonial situation where we don't have any votes, so nobody wants to pay any attention. And then we have this big, huge Democratic view right now. And so what happens? We don't know what's going to happen when we become a state. So that's my rant on
that. Well, I like it.
It's absolutely true.
Act ahead, as Marie. If when we become a state, your verbiage. And in other words, for how long now has everyone said, if we become a state, if we can become a state, if, and now I like what I'm hearing with the paradigm shift, it seems, especially since what happened last week. That it, you know, the troops are marching on, if you will, to make D.C.
a
state.
That's right. Yeah. Well, that markup was amazing. I mean, I was sitting behind you, Senator, and I, you know, I don't know whether you realized it, but when we got to that last vote, I had to stand up. I stood up for the last vote where people were deciding. We're saying, yes, we're going to send this to the House floor, because I felt like they are voting for my citizenship.
Mm.
And I had to stand up. And by the time they were like a third way through, I had tears running down my cheeks.
I would imagine. It had to be terribly emotional.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was a very partisan hearing, because I remember one of the things that I remember about you, Ann, from the hearing, is that you and I were both shaking our heads, you know, when they tried to throw every amendment they could think of, you know, right? You just wanted to stand up and scream, hey, this is about civil rights. It's not about immigration. This is about civil rights. It's not about guns,
right.
Yeah. And, you know, that was, a tough thing to have to sit there and listen to. But in the end, you're right. It was great. And let me ask you this question. because you talked about tears running down your face. When I was, I've been to every convention for the last, Democratic convention for the last 40 years, and in 1984, I happened to be right at the front of the stage when Geraldine Ferraro from New York got up and gave her acceptance speech as the first woman candidate for a major party that was on a ticket of a major party. And I want to tell you, it was a very moving experience for me because yes. I was surrounded by women who were sobbing over this, who had worked so hard, so long for, women's rights, and they were just, and if you remember in 1984, Ferraro came kind of out of the blue. She was, she wasn't somebody that everybody was talking about as a running mate, and then Mondale picked her, and unfortunately, they didn't let her give as fiery a speech as she could have given because they didn't want her to outshine Walter Mondale, which was not a particularly hard thing to do. Great guy, but not nearly as exciting as Ferraro was. But my question to you is: here we've gone. It's been 40 years, and even though England, France, Germany, India, Israel, all these countries have had women leaders, we've yet to elect a woman leader. What do you think about that?
Well, about 20 years ago, shortly after apartheid was demolished in South Africa, I was in South Africa. I was working with a nonprofit on other issues, on peace issues, and I met with some of the South African women legislators, and because South Africa says it's got to be 50-50, 50 women, 50 men, 50%. Mm-hmm. And so here I'm sitting there at lunch, and these lovely women say, so we don't understand, why is it that you have so few women in your legislature? And I had to say, you're just ahead of us. There's not a way to explain this other than sexism. Uh-huh. And a long time of coming of age, perhaps, as we might think, of finally thinking, we're cutting off 50% or more than 50% of the really talented population in our country when we say, well, we can't have women leaders for some reason or another. So,
well, does the League of Women Voters promote that too? Promote getting women elected and actively go and support women's campaigns, help them?
No, because, as soon as we support a campaign, then we become partisan.
I see.
So it's a really interesting line that we really need to pay attention to. And we really believe that it's important to be as nonpartisan as possible. Because that's why we just don't ever support any campaign at all. And we don't support any party. So, because, what's really important for us is to pay attention to the good government issues, to the voter protection issues, to the voter education issues. I mean, that's why the League of Women Voters was established. It was between the time that the 19th Amendment was ratified, was passed in the Congress, and it was ratified, in that time frame, women leaders back then said, we're suddenly going to have millions of women who can vote, and they will have never voted before, and they will not have been educated about how to even go about looking at issues. So that's why the League of Women Voters was established. And right off the bat, they said, we have to be nonpartisan so that people will understand that we are trying to help people understand who's out there, not who should be or shouldn't be, but who is out there, who's running for Congress.
So because of that, Anne, I would assume that the League of Women Voters is behind the ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment, because that's nonpartisan.
Exactly.
Yeah, so let's move on
talk about
that for a minute.
Yeah.
Yes, please.
We just had the Equal Rights Amendment, if the listeners don't know. We've just had the Equal Rights Amendment ratified by the state of Virginia, which gives it enough ratification to pass. And let me just tell you what the ERA says. It's pretty simple. It says that equality of rights under the law shall not be abridged by the United States or any state on the account of sex, and that Congress has the right to enforce that, and that the amendment would take effect 2 years after ratification. So it's pretty straightforward. It just says that you can't discriminate on the basis of sex, and that is enshrined in our Constitution. But we see now, Anne, that three lovely states, led by Alabama, where I have a lot of family, I don't get this, but Alabama, Louisiana, and South Dakota are all in court suing and try to take back their ratification. So do you have any sense of that? My sense of it is that the court, that this will be treated, strangely enough, much like statehood. You know, we've gone into court many times with statehood, and the court says, you don't have a legal battle. You don't have a legal fight here. You have a political fight. You think they'll rule that way about the Equal Rights Amendment, too? That it's not, I mean, it's Congress that sets the rules, so why would the court, you know, I don't understand that why the court would intervene if Congress wants to extend the right for ratification, which they've done over and over again.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm reluctant to predict court decisions.
Yeah, well, I have no legal training, so I'm not reluctant at all.
Well, I don't have any legal training either. And I'm still reluctant to predict, but I can tell you that I certainly hope that people understand that it's taken a long time to get the last state, Virginia, just ratified it, and that puts it over the top in terms of how many states need to be ratifying it. And so I don't know what will happen, but I certainly feel like it's been a long time coming, and we really need to support this effort to go ahead and accept the fact that women are equal in under the eyes of the law. You know, it's not something that you ought to be able to discriminate, and then, you know, wonderful things could happen. Like, you could actually get paid for your hourly wage at the same level for the same job. Wouldn't that be?
Imagine.
Yeah, something amazing. Yeah. It's,
you know what's always
really
bothered me at about the Equal Rights Amendment movement, about the feminist movement around the Equal Rights Amendment? When I was in college, I worked on it. And what I didn't, you know, we know that the ERA fell prey to a housewife from Indiana named Phyllis Schlafly. And one of the reasons was that those of us on the liberal side that supported it reached out to people that already supported it. You know, we did commercials with Alan Alda and people who weren't going to convince anybody on the right. They were just preaching to the choir. But I never understood why the movement didn't address men and say, look, if your wife is making 78 cents on a dollar, you're getting cheated. You know, your family's getting
cheated. That's a really good point.
Yeah, because, right, you're making less money. You're going to have to put your kids through college someday or pay the mortgage or whatever you're doing. So this isn't just about women. This is about families. This is about everybody. And And, you know, I think that's a mistake we make, too, in the statehood movement, is that we think the righteousness of our cause will carry the day. And I think it's always better to be a little more practical, you know, talk about the practical implications. Because, yeah, I don't want my wife doing the same job as a man and making 78 cents on the dollar, because she pays for a lot of things around here. So, I've just never really gotten that.
It's embarrassing that we're having this conversation in this day and age.
Yeah,
I mean,
I agree with you, Maria.
I mean, it's like, it's just common sense. And I don't know where and why there was backlash, really, because as you said, there's more practical applications to it. And we have two legs and two eyes and two arms and two legs, and we have different genitalia. But other than that, we're a human being on this planet. But the fact that the House voted to remove the deadline on ratifying the ERA, you would think would make it get some momentum, too, because it was supposed to be ratified in 79 and they bumped it to 82. And that's why it was in limbo land until these last three states did it. But now there's talk that whoever is supposed to sign off on it said that he's not going to sign off on it. He has some official capacity that he's, I suppose, to make it signed, sealed, and delivered. So how come one person gets to make 38 states null and void?
Well, I don't know the answer
really
to that
question.
Yeah, it is a good question. I don't know why. And you know what? You know, I think women, the bottom line here is that women just need to rise up, and I think they are. I know the good news is that I see my two daughters, my oldest daughter, Trisha, I can't imagine you telling her that there's something she can't do because of her sex. I mean, that wouldn't even occur to her that there'd be, she's not going to be president of the United States because she doesn't want to be president of the United States. But if you told her she couldn't do it, she would look at you like you were crazy, you know. And so that's a good thing. I think we've raised a generation of women. Thanks not only to a change in the culture, but a change in our legal system, right? Title IX, look at how much Title IX has done, how it's affected, how it's affected women and you know, I think much like D.C. statehood, again, I think the ERA is a fait accompli. I think that, you know, we're going to have to fight. There's going to be more battles maybe and more hurdles to get over, but sooner or later, it's going to pass. It's going to become part of our Constitution, which it should be, you know.
Well, you know, the other part of that is that, you know, you talked about how families are affected. Well, there are also plenty of women who are sole supporters of their families.
Right.
So, you know, it's not a matter of, it's simply a matter of fairness, and it needs to be clear, and people need to be able to count on our full law, you know. I mean, and let's remember as we're thinking about this, that there are still, like, for instance, to come back to D.C. statehood, you know, when the D.C. League was recognized, and we're going to be 100 years old, too, on April 22nd, when we were recognized back in the day by the National League, the D.C. League called itself the Voteless League of Women Voters, because while everybody else in the country, although we have to remember it was only some women, like white women, who actually were able to get the vote in most places, you know, the people in Washington, D.C. still didn't get the vote, you know? So,
yeah.
No, either men or women. And that's, you know, okay, in 1964, we finally got the 23rd Amendment to be able to vote for president. And, you know, that was the first year I actually moved to Washington, D.C., was in 1964. It was also the first time I was able to vote. And that's part of what's kept me going, because I saw democracy bloom right there in front of me.
Well,
it's
I'm sorry. Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I just, it just felt like, okay, now we're on the road. Okay, there was a problem, but now we're on the road. And then, in 1971, that was when this new idea about statehood, where you could shrink the federal district once again and make the rest of us where we live a state, that made sense to me. And it just felt like, well, we're moving along here. So, it's about growing democracy.
Well, and I've got to tell you, my grandmother, I remember this as a child, my grandmother who wasn't allowed to vote, my grandmother would have been about 130 years old if she were alive today. When she was a young woman, she wasn't allowed to vote. She voted in every election. She got dressed up. Election day was a big deal. She went to the polls. She never missed. And you know what? I grew up in North New Jersey. It was a very corrupt city. I grew up in the Italian neighborhood. She was Italian. She probably voted for lots of corrupt politicians in her time, but she never missed voting. She didn't really see voting so much as a right, I think, as she saw it as a responsibility. That women didn't have that right, and now that they had that right, they had to exercise it. That they owed it to all those women who had stood up for the right, and all those women who had been denied. They owed it to them to make sure that they always voted. I think we're seeing that again. I see it in my daughters. I will say that they've gotten more politically active lately because they see a rise in sexism in our society and xenophobia and other things that they firmly disagree with. But I think that you're right. We're moving along. We're moving in that direction, and it'll be a brighter day for everybody when the Equal Rights Amendment, I think, gets into the Constitution and women are finally recognized as full-fledged citizens. It seems to me that it's like the issue of marriage equality, that it's not, that it wasn't enough to say that you could have legal unions. You had to say that marriage was equal. And I think you have to say that with women. There are a lot of people that seem to argue that, they have all these rights that are already, ensconced in local and state laws. But the truth is, they still make 78 cents or maybe a little more than that on a dollar. They still don't make as much as men. They still don't get the same benefits. And they should be part of the Constitution.
And if I can just plug into that because come back to your idea that it's actually men who are also harmed by this lack of equality. And when I think about that and I think about, men, like for instance, what about having, the family leave, paid family leave for both?
Right.
So guess what? I'm a clinical social worker. I work with children. I know how important it is for men, for fathers, to be able to be with their children and bond with them just like their mothers. It's important to the kids. It's important to the parents. So then if a mom gets to stay home even with paid family leave, but dad has to go to work all the time and probably work two jobs because mom can't work because she's home taking care of the kid, so then he doesn't see the kid, so then there's a break. There's an emotional break there. And
absolutely,
that's not fair. That's not fair.
Well, and I agree, and I think that we need to push bring that out more with men, because I don't think men see it that way. And, I got to tell you, I personally, I don't know if it's better to be a man or a woman in the world, but I know it's easier to be a man. There's no doubt in my mind that I have had great advantages accrue to me on the basis of sex. Any relationship, there's always something to be gained if you cooperate. So I think that if you approach men more, I think that we're slow on the uptake, but I think we're getting the message. Let me ask you: we have two women candidates now who are in the midst. I know you guys don't support any particular candidates, but what do you think? What do you think of the fact that now we have more women in Congress than we've ever had before? We have two women who are viable candidates for the Democratic nomination. This is the first time that's ever happened. So are women coming of age politically? I know that my sister graduated from GW Law School in 1964. And she was one of two women graduates, and now they graduate more women than they graduate men. So it seems to me that the more women that get into Congress, the more women you're going to get in Congress.
I think it's really important for good government to have a wide range of views and perspectives involved in the lawmaking. So, you know, I'm very encouraged to see more women. I'm encouraged to see more people of color. I'm encouraged to see I would like our Congress, you know, in terms of good government, to look like the people it represents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's where diversity comes in.
That's the best way to do it. Yeah.
So,
I want to go back to D.C. because I think it's really important for us to understand, and, you know, I've been doing all this research because this is our centennial in D.C. Did you know that in 1938, this is speaking of voting, in 1938, the D.C. League of Women Voters was instrumental in getting the first plebiscite. That's where people get to vote. You know, you just go and vote, along with 271 other community organizations. They organized a district-wide plebiscite, and they asked two questions. Would you like to be represented in our national legislature? And would you like to be in charge of your local government? And guess what? They said yes.
What a surprise.
Emphatically.
Yeah.
And so I think in terms of, you know, thinking about the power of women, you know, it's not necessarily recognized, hasn't been recognized over time, but, you know, there's been lots of things that women have done and that have made huge differences in a lot of different places. And I think it's really important that we acknowledge those even as we go forward with then making decisions about who we put in office.
I agree with you. And for me, it was never a surprise because I was raised by my Italian grandmother who ran our family like she was Don Corleone. And, you know, she was always the center of power. But, you know, culturally, these things die really, really hard. I wouldn't be truthful if I didn't tell you that my wife calls me one of the world's great theoretical feminists because she says, you know, I think all women should be equal except for her and my two daughters. And there's a modicum of truth in that, you know, that it's hard sometimes. You know, I see myself that you know, where I might want to push my son out into the forefront, I want to protect my daughter, and you know what I mean? And I have to be conscious of those things that, and I think we all do too. It takes a re-education on everybody's part. And, you know, as you raise children, Maria's got a bunch of children too. You know, they always, you know, they get to an age where they start doing things and you're amazed, aren't you, Maria? I mean, I'm amazed sometimes, you know, because you tend to think of them as you thought of them when they were 7, 8, 9 years old. You know,
and proud. And I want to ask about the League of Women Voters. Do you solicit members, and do you solicit men and women? And what does it mean to be a member of the League of Women Voters, and why should people care?
Ah, thank you. Yes, membership is open to both women and men, and we have a number of men all over the country. There are probably 730, I think, leagues, local leagues, and state leagues. And basically, what we, as members of the League of Women Voters, is we get to say, this is what I'm interested in. And we work with our neighbors and our local colleagues to say, these are the things that are really important to our local communities. And by coming together and talking about those kinds of issues and saying, well, wait a minute, you know, what do we know about these issues? Let's study them. Let's figure out what we really decide and decide at the local level that these are the things that we're really concerned about. And then that's where that level of local democracy then moves forward and up. Like, this is why we really are grassroots, because a local league member can actually vote and in there and come to consensus at the local level, and then that issue that we're concerned about, like for instance DC statehood. I mean, we moved the DC statehood issue up to the national level by creating a resolution from the DC League to the national convention, and then we lobbied the national convention and said to all the delegates, you need to help us get statehood, because this is the only way to become an equal member of this society, to be part of the 50 states, only 51 states. And they heard us, and they passed the resolution at the national level. So it's like that kind of thing can, and there are all sort. I mean, there are environmental issues, there's money in politics issues, there's ranked choice voting. Those are only some of the issues that that local leagues have indicated are of real concern, that have eventually made it up to the national level. And then the national league says, okay, here's what we're hearing from our members.
Which is the essential definition of grassroots.
Exactly.
So do you meet regularly, and do you have dues? And like, how does it work? Or does each one work differently?
Well, excuse me. The every league at the local level has specific dues. Like, for instance, in Washington, D.C., we have dues that are $50 for the year. We have student dues that are $10 for the year. We pay part of those dues into the National League to help support the larger community of leagues. And people then are voted to become members. I mean, to become members of the state, of the local board, the state board, the national board. And so you grow leaders. And like, for instance, when we were, I mean, you can grow leaders in all kinds of ways. For instance, when we were doing the statehood, because I'm the chair of the full rights for DC Citizens Committee of the DC League, the first thing we did once we got our study done of the D.C. statehood issue was we started training people to be able to talk about it. So part of what you get is support for building your own leadership, your own leadership skills in a league context. And then if you're interested in that, you know, well, we've had people recently who are interested in the environmental issues. And we said, great, you know, why don't you help us connect with some of the other organizations who are concerned about the environment, because there's only so much volunteer effort. Most leagues are all volunteer. There are some leagues that are big enough that they've been able to, you know, support a part-time office manager or something like that, and some kind of administrator. But most leagues are small, like, you know, between 150 and 300 people who pay dues. And then, of course, you know, some of those people can only pay dues because they're working three jobs. Or some of them, like me, are partially retired, and so, you know, we can put in some more time.
Well, let me ask.
Does that
you,
help?
What do you
yeah, absolutely. You're making me want to join.
Please.
You should.
I love it. Both
sure
of you.
I'm sure there's a chapter in California.
Oh, there are
chapter,
many chapters.
I'm sure there's a chapter or two in California.
Probably in Los Angeles.
Well, what about local elections? Do you keep an eye? Today, there was a disturbing article in the Washington Post that the local Board of Elections sent out 5,000, did you read this, voter registration cards, and they had the wrong date of the election. They're telling people it's the third Tuesday in November, or in June, rather, and it's actually June 2nd is the primary. Do you get involved in any of that stuff? Like, you know.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, you do.
We have people who are, who, you know, once we decide on a position, then if there's something that comes up, for instance, in front of the D.C. Council, we're very apt to put in written testimony, or we may testify in person. We also might write letters to our local leaders of, you know, and whether, I mean, D.C., it's the D.C. Council, but there are, for instance, right now, there's this people-powered Fair Maps campaign. I should talk about that.
Yeah, what is that?
Well, you know, after the Supreme Court said, well, we really can't do anything about partisan gerrymandering, the D.C. League, or the U.S. League said, oh, okay, we have to take this up, because this is about voter protection. We want to be able to have voters choose candidates, not candidates choose voters. So we need to have independent redistricting commissions in as many different places as we can make that happen if that's needed. And because there are some states that already had them or whatever. So this is a 50-state and the District of Columbia effort. And that was part of what the Day of Action was about on February 14th. There are leagues all over the country who are looking at how is the redistricting going to happen after this census. You know, because the census counts the people, and then the each state figures out how they're going to redistrict. You know, redraw the lines to keep the populations, supposedly keep the populations equal, so that when you send a representative to Congress, they are representing pretty much the same number of people as the next district over. So we want independent redistricting commissions. And in D.C., we're saying this is great and we want to be on the map. No, we would like to be on the map as a state. So our focus for this is about statehood. But in the meantime, we're also looking at ranked choice voting, at money in politics. I mean, all of these things are critical at the local level.
Well, and I don't think very often, because maybe it's a little technical, that people understand how not only how important things like redistricting are, but also what partisan battles they become. I mean, they're just and it's absolutely essential to you know, legislation as it progresses to have the right representation in terms of you know, adequate distribution of people to not gerrymander.
That's
we certainly
right.
I train Native Americans who wanted to run for public office, and we've been very successful with it. And that was the thing, that was the argument we always made with them. We said, look, you know, they all have their own tribal government, so sometimes they don't participate in the wider government, which, much to their chagrin, works against them, even though they may not know it. And that's what we always say. We always start out by saying, if you're not at the table, you don't get fed. So you've gotta be represented. And of course, that's the nexus of DC statehood as well. Well, we're running out of time here, Maria. So do you have any other questions for
I do. Ann? I think, Ann, you should talk about vote411.org.
Oh, good. Thank you. Because that was the other thing I thought of is, oh, that's right. At the local level, this is the other thing that we do. This is the other service to the voters. Each local league, if they are capable of doing that, because some of them are just too small, but if we do our best every election, and so, for instance, at our next membership meeting in D.C., we're going to be looking at what kinds of questions do we want to ask all of the candidates.
Mm.
And we do our best to make them no gotcha questions, no partisanship questions. but we want to make sure that everybody has a chance to answer the questions that that our citizens might be interested in knowing about. And so we really hope the of course, we send all the candidates all of the questions that we come up with, and again, it's a grassroots process. So we're soliciting questions that should be asked of the candidates. And all over the country, we are using that. And then they get posted online at Vote411. And so you can actually go, it's a nationwide, you can actually go and put in your address. And what will come up will be, you're in this district, you will be voting on this House of Representatives, these senators, and so on. And then you can click on each candidate, and it will give you all of the questions that they have answered. And of course, you can also know something about them if they haven't answered any questions.
Wow.
And
what a resource that is.
Yeah, I've answered really that question. I've answered that questionnaire in the past.
I know. Thank you very much for doing that. Appreciate it.
Well, and you know what? I must say, I'm very proud. Maria knows that I ran a communications company for 25 years. Well, one of my clients during that period of time was the D.C. League of Women Voters. I did the newsletter for a lovely woman named Louise Lynn Bloom, who used to run their communications department many, many years ago. So I was always very proud of that. And I'd also like to say to you, Ann, that when I testified before the United States Senate, you were so kind. I was so nervous. And you made a point to come up to me afterwards and give me a hug. So I always appreciated that. And
pleased to do it.
Yeah, and we're glad that you are on the show. And we hope you'll come back as things progress. There were things that I wanted to talk to you about, like the Women's March and other things. But unfortunately, we're running out of time. So thank you so much, Ann, for being with us. If I haven't made my contribution to League of Women Voters, I'll look at my checkbook and make sure I join again, because you're a great organization. And anything you want to say, Maria? We're going to play you out tonight with a song that we all know by Aretha Franklin, because we talked a lot about the ERA today, and that's really all it's about, people. It's about a modicum of respect for the women of America who have added so much to the lives of all of us that they deserve this recognition. So, Anne, Maria, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, just to thank you, Anne, for what you do and to all of your volunteerism and to our listeners who always make our program a part of their lives. We are very grateful. Thank you.
Thank you. Delightful to be here.
Okay. Bye. See you next week.
Bye-bye.
Give the people their right to vote.